so much which softened the whole narrative. It's very possible that it had been in my mind a long time and had gradually engendered my determination. As I didn't even know where Miss Betsy lived, I wrote a long letter to Peggotty and asked her, incidentally, if she remembered, pretending that I had heard of such a lady living at a certain place I named at random, and had a curiosity to know if it were the same. In the course of that letter, I told Peggotty that I had a particular occasion for half a guinea, and that if she could lend me that sum until I could repay it, I should be very much obliged to her, and would tell her afterwards what I'd wanted it for. Peggotty's answer soon arrived, and was, as usual, full of affectionate devotion. She enclosed the half guinea. I was afraid she must have had a world of trouble to get it out of Mr. Barkis's box, and told me that Miss Betsy lived near Dover. But whether at Dover itself, at Hythe, Sandgate, or Folkestone, she couldn't say. One of our men, however, informing me on my asking him about these places that they were all close together, I deemed this enough for my object and resolved to set out at the end of that week. Being a very honest little creature, and unwilling to disgrace the memory I was going to leave behind me at Murdstone and Grinby's, I considered myself bound to remain until Saturday night. And, as I had been paid a week's wages in advance when I first came there, not to present myself in the counting-house at the usual hour to receive my stipend. For this express reason I had borrowed the half-guinea that I might not be without a fund for my travelling expenses. Accordingly, when the Saturday night came, and we were all waiting in the warehouse to be paid, and Tip, the carman, who always took precedence, went in first to draw his money, I shook Mick Walker by the hand, asked him, when it came to his turn to be paid, to say to Mr. Quinion that I had gone to move my box to Tip's, and bidding a last good night to Mealy Potatoes, ran away. My box was at my old lodging over the water, and I had written a direction for it on the back of one of our address cards that we nailed on the casks. Master David, to be left till called for at the coach office, Dover. This I had in my pocket, ready to put on the box, after I should have got it out of the house. And as I went towards my lodgings, I looked about me for someone who would help me to carry it to the booking office. There was a long-legged young man with a very little empty donkey cart standing near the obelisk in the Blackfriars Road, whose eye I caught as I was going by, and who, addressing me as Sixpenneth of Bad Eightpence, hoped I should know him again to swear to, in allusion, I have no doubt, to my staring at him. I stopped to assure him that I had not done so in bad manners, but uncertain whether he might or might not like a job. "What job?" said the long-legged young man. "To move a box," I answered. "What box?" said the long-legged young man. I told him mine, which was down that street there, and which I wanted him to take to the Dover coach office for sixpence. "Done with you for a tanner," said the long-legged young man, and directly got upon his cart, which was nothing but a large wooden tray on wheels, and rattled away at such a rate that it was as much as I could do to keep pace with the donkey. There was a defiant manner about this young man, and particularly about the way in which he chewed straw as he spoke to me, that I didn't much like. As the bargain was made, however, I took him upstairs to the room I was leaving, and we brought the box down and put it on his cart. Now, I was unwilling to put the direction card on there, lest any of my landlord's family should fathom what I was doing and detain me. So I said to the young man that I would be glad if he would stop for a minute when he came to the dead wall of the King's Bench Prison. The words were no sooner out of my mouth than he rattled away as if he, my box, the cart, and the donkey were all equally mad. And I was quite out of breath with running and calling after him when I caught him at the place appointed. Being much flushed and excited, I tumbled my half-guinea out of my pocket in pulling the card out. I put it in my mouth for safety, and though my hands trembled a good deal, had just tied the card on very much to my satisfaction, when I felt myself violently chucked under the chin by the long-legged young man, and saw my half-guinea fly out of my mouth into his hand. "What?" said the young man, seizing me by my jacket collar with a frightful grin. "This is a Polish case, isn't it? You're a going to bolt, are you? Come to the Polish, you young warming, come to the Polish!" "You give me my money back, if you please," said I, very much frightened, "and leave me alone." "Come to the police," said the young man. "You shall prove it yourn to the police." "Give me my box and money, will you?" I cried, bursting into tears. The young man still replied, "Come to the police," and was dragging me against the donkey in a violent manner, as if there were any affinity between that animal and a magistrate, when he changed his mind, jumped into the cart, sat upon my box, and exclaiming that he would drive to the police straight, rattled away harder than ever. I ran after him as fast as I could, but I had no breath to call out with, and shouldn't have dared to call out now if I had. I narrowly escaped being run over 20 times at least in half a mile. Now I lost him, now I saw him, now I lost him, now I was cut at with a whip, now shouted at, now down in the mud, now up again, now running into somebody's arms, now running headlong at a post. At length, confused by fright and heat, and doubting whether half London might not by this time be turning out for my apprehension, I left the young man to go where he would with my box and money, and panting and crying, but never stopping, faced about for Greenwich, which I had understood was on the Dover Road. Taking very little more out of the world towards the retreat of my aunt, Miss Betsy, than I had brought into it on the night when my arrival gave her so much umbrage. Chapter 13, the sequel of my resolution. For anything I know, I may have had some wild idea of running all the way to Dover when I gave up the pursuit of the young man with the donkey cart and started for Greenwich. My scattered senses were soon collected as to that point, if I had, for I came to a stop in the Kent Road at a terrace with a piece of water before it, and a great foolish image in the middle blowing a dry shell. Here I sat down on a doorstep, quite spent and exhausted with the efforts I had already made, and with hardly breath enough to cry for the loss of my box and half-guinea. It was by this time dark. I heard the clock strike 10 as I sat resting, but it was a summer night, fortunately, in fine weather. When I'd recovered my breath, and had got rid of a stifling sensation in my throat, I rose up and went on. In the midst of my distress, I had no notion of going back. I doubt if I should have had any, though there'd been a Swiss snowdrift in the Kent Road. But my standing possessed of only 3 halfpence in the world, and I'm sure I wonder how they came to be left in my pocket on a Saturday night, troubled me nonetheless because I went on. I began to picture to myself, as a scrap of newspaper intelligence, my being found dead in a day or two under some hedge. And I trudged on miserably, though as fast as I could, until I happened to pass a little shop where it was written up that ladies and gentlemen's wardrobes were bought, and that the best price was given for rags, bones, and kitchen stuff. The master of this shop was sitting at the door in his shirt sleeves, smoking. And as there were a great many coats and pairs of trousers dangling from the low ceiling, and only 2 feeble candles burning inside to show what they were, I fancied that he looked like a man of a revengeful disposition who had hung all his enemies and was enjoying himself. My late experiences with Mr. and Mrs. Micawber suggested to me that here might be a means of keeping off the wolf for a little while. I went up the next by-street, took off my waistcoat, rolled it neatly under my arm, and came back to the shop door. "If you please, sir," I said, "I am to sell this for a fair price." Mr. Dollaby was the name over the shop door, at least, took the waistcoat, stood his pipe on its head against the doorpost, went into the shop, followed by me, snuffed the two candles with his fingers, spread the waistcoat on the counter, and looked at it there. Held it up against the light, and looked at it there, and ultimately said, "What do you call a price now for this here little waistcoat?" "Oh, you know best, sir," I returned modestly. "I can't be buyer and seller too," said Mr. Dolloby. "Put a price on this here little waistcoat." "Would 18 pence be..." I hinted after some hesitation. Mr. Dolloby rolled it up again and gave it me back. "I should rob my family," he said, "if I was to offer 9 pence for it." This was a disagreeable way of putting the business, because it imposed upon me, a perfect stranger, the unpleasantness of asking Mr. Dolloby to rob his family on my account. My circumstances being so very pressing, however, I said I would take 9 pence for it, if you please. Mr. Dolloby, not without some grumbling, gave 9 pence. I wished him good night and walked out of the shop the richer by that sum and the poorer by a waistcoat. But when I buttoned my jacket, that wasn't much. Indeed, I foresaw pretty clearly that my jacket would go next, and that I should have to make the best of my way to Dover in a shirt and a pair of trousers, and might deem myself lucky if I got there even in that trim. But my mind didn't run so much on this as might be supposed. Beyond a general impression of the distance before me, and of the young man with the donkey cart having used me cruelly, I think I had no very urgent sense of my difficulties when I once again set off with my 9 pence in my pocket. A plan had occurred to me for passing the night which I was going to carry into execution. This was to lie behind the wall at the back of my old school, in a corner where there used to be a haystack. I imagined it would be a kind of company to have the boys and the bedroom where I used to tell the stories so near me, although the boys would know nothing of my being there, and the bedroom would yield me no shelter. I'd had a hard day's work and was pretty well jaded when I came climbing out at last upon the level of Blackheath. It cost me some trouble to find out Salem House, but I found it. And I found a haystack in the corner, and I lay down by it, having first walked round the wall and looked up at the windows, and seen that all was dark and silent within. Never shall I forget the lonely sensation of first lying down without a roof above my head. Sleep came upon me as it came on many other outcasts against whom house doors were locked and house dogs barked that night, and I dreamt of lying on my old school bed, talking to the boys in my room, and found myself sitting upright with Steerforth's name upon my lips, looking wildly at the stars that were glistening and glimmering above me. When I remembered where I was at that untimely hour, a feeling stole upon me that made me get up, afraid of I don't know what, and walk about. But the fainter glimmering of the stars and the pale light in the sky where the day was coming reassured me. And my eyes being very heavy, I lay down again and slept, though with a knowledge in my sleep that it was cold, until the warm beams of the sun and the ringing of the getting-up bell at Salem House awoke me. If I could have hoped that Steerforth was there, I would have lurked about until he came out alone, but I knew he must have left long since. Traddles still remained, perhaps, but it was very doubtful, and I hadn't sufficient confidence in his discretion or good luck, however strong my reliance was on his good nature, to wish to trust him with my situation. So I crept away from the wall as Mr. Creakle's boys were getting up, and struck into the long, dusty track which I had first known to be the Dover Road when I was one of them, and when I little expected that any eyes would ever see me the wayfarer I was now upon it. What a different Sunday morning from the old Sunday morning at Yarmouth! In due time I heard the church bells ringing as I plodded on, and I met people who were going to church. And I passed a church or two where the congregation were inside, and the sound of singing came out slipped into the sunshine while the beadle sat and cooled himself in the shade of the porch, or stood beneath the yew tree with his hand to his forehead, glowering at me going by. But the peace and rest of the old Sunday morning were on everything except me. That was the difference. I felt quite wicked in my dirt and dust and with my tangled hair. But for the quiet picture I had conjured up of my mother in her youth and beauty weeping by the fire and my aunt relenting to her, I hardly think I should have had courage to go on until next day. But it always went before me, and I followed.
This ends side two of cassette six of David Copperfield. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette seven. Cassette 7.
I got that Sunday through 3 and 20 miles on the straight road, though not very easily, for I was new to that kind of toil. I see myself, as evening closes in, coming over the bridge at Rochester, footsore and tired, and eating bread that I'd bought for supper. One or two little houses with the notice "Lodgings for Travellers" hanging out had tempted me, but I was afraid of spending the few pence I had, and was even more afraid of the vicious looks of the trampers I had met or overtaken. I sought no shelter, therefore, but the sky, and toiling into Chatham, which in that night's aspect is a mere dream of chalk and drawbridges and mastless ships in a muddy river roofed like Noah's Arks, crept at last upon a sort of grass-grown battery overhanging a lane, where a sentry was walking to and fro. Here I lay down, near a cannon, and happy in the society of the sentry's footsteps, though he knew no more of my being above him than the boys at Salem House had known of my lying by the wall, slept soundly until morning. Very stiff and sore of foot I was in the morning, and quite dazed by the beating of drums and marching of troops, which seemed to hem me in on every side when I went down towards the long, narrow street, feeling that I could go but a very little way that day, if I were to reserve any strength for getting to my journey's end, I resolved to make the sale of my jacket its principal business. Accordingly, I took the jacket off, that I might learn to do without it, and, carrying it under my arm, began a tour of inspection of the various slop shops. It was a likely place to sell a jacket in, for the dealers in second-hand clothes were numerous, and were, generally speaking, on the lookout for customers at their shop doors. But as most of them had hanging up among their stock an officer's coat or two, epaulettes and all, I was rendered timid by the costly nature of their dealings, and walked about for a long time without offering my merchandise to anyone. This modesty of mine directed my attention to the marine store shops, and such shops as Mr. Dollaby's, in preference to the regular dealers. At last I found one that I thought looked promising, at the corner of a dirty lane, ending in an enclosure full of stinging nettles, against the palings of which some second-hand sailors' clothes that seemed to have overflowed the shop were fluttering among some cots and rusty guns and oilskin hats, and certain trays full of so many old rusty keys of so many sizes that they seemed various enough to open all the doors in the world. Into this shop, which was low and small, and which was darkened rather than lighted by a little window overhung with clothes, and was descended into by some steps, I went with a palpitating heart, which was not relieved when an ugly old man, with the lower part of his face all covered with a stubbly grey beard, rushed out of a dirty den behind it and seized me by the hair of my head. He was a dreadful old man to look at, in a filthy flannel waistcoat and smelling terribly of ruin. His bedstead, covered with a tumbled and ragged piece of patchwork, was in the den he'd come from, where another little window showed a prospect of more stinging nettles and a lame donkey. "Oh, "Well, what do you want?" grinned this old man, in a fierce, monotonous whine. "Oh, my eyes and limbs, what do you want? Oh, my lungs and liver, what do you want? Oh, guru, guru!" I was so much dismayed by these words, and particularly by the repetition of the last unknown one, which was a kind of rattle in his throat, that I could make no answer. Hereupon the old man, still holding me by the hair, repeated, "Oh, what do you want? Oh, my eyes and limbs, what do you want? Oh, my lungs and liver, what do you want? Oh, grow!" which he screwed out of himself with an energy that made his eyes start in his head. "I wanted to know," I said, trembling, "if you would buy a jacket." "Oh, let's see the jacket!" cried the old man. "Oh, my heart's on fire! Show the jacket to us! Oh, my eyes and limbs, bring the jacket out!" With that he took his trembling hands, which were like the claws of a great bird, out of my hair, and put on a pair of spectacles, not at all ornamental to his inflamed eyes. "Oh, well, much for the jacket!" cried the old man after examining it. "Oh, grrr, how much for the jacket?" "Half a crown," I answered, recovering myself. "Oh, my lungs and liver," cried the old man. "No, oh, my eyes, no, oh, my limbs, no, 18 pence, grrr." Every time he uttered this ejaculation, his eyes seemed to be in danger of starting out. And every sentence he spoke, he delivered in a sort of tune, always exactly the same, and more like a gust of wind which begins low, mounts up high and falls again than any other comparison I can find for it. "Well," said I, glad to have closed the bargain, "I'll take 18 pence. "Oh, my liver!" cried the old man, throwing the jacket on a shelf. "Get out of the shop! Oh, my lungs, get out of the shop! Oh, my eyes and limbs, don't ask for money, make it an exchange!" I never was so frightened in my life before or since. But I told him humbly that I wanted money, and that nothing else was of any use to me, but that I would wait for it as he desired outside, and had no wish to hurry him, so I went outside and sat down in the shade in a corner. And I sat there so many hours that the shade became sunlight, and the sunlight became shade again, and still I sat there waiting for the money. There never was such another drunken madman in that line of business, I hope. That he was well known in the neighbourhood and enjoyed the reputation of having sold himself to the devil, I soon understood from the visits he received from the boys, who continually came skirmishing about the shop, shouting that legend, and calling to him to bring out his gold. "You ain't poor, you know, Charlie, as you pretend. Bring out your gold. Bring out some of the gold you sold yourself to the devil for. Come, it's in the lining of the mattress, Charlie. Rip it open and let's have some." This, and many offers to lend him a knife for the purpose, exasperated him to such a degree that the whole day was a succession of rushes on his part and flights on the part of the boys. Sometimes in his rage he would take me for one of them and come at me mouthing as if he were going to tear me in pieces, then, remembering me just in time, would dive into the shop and lie upon his bed, as I thought from the sound of his voice, yelling in a frantic way to his own windy tune The Death of Nelson, with an "Oh!" before every line, and innumerable "Gurus" interspersed. As if this were not bad enough for me, the boys, connecting me with the establishment on account of the patience and perseverance with which I sat outside, half-dressed, pelted me, and used me very ill all day. He made many attempts to induce me to consent to an exchange, at one time coming out with a fishing rod, at another with a fiddle, at another with a cocked hat, at another with a flute. But I resisted all these overtures, and sat there in desperation, each time asking him with tears in my eyes for money or my jacket. At last he began to pay me in halfpence at a time, and was full 2 hours getting by easy stages to a shilling. "Oh, my eyes and limbs," he then cried, peeping hideously out of the shop after a long pause. "Will you go for twopence more?" "I can't," I said. "I shall be starved." "Oh, my lungs and liver, will you go for threepence?" "I would go for nothing if I could," I said, "but I want the money badly." "Oh, go!" It's really impossible to express how he twisted this ejaculation out of himself as he peeped round the doorpost at me, showing nothing but his crafty old head. Will you go for fourpence? I was so faint and weary that I closed with this offer, and taking the money out of his claw, not without trembling, went away more hungry and thirsty than I'd ever been a little before sunset. But at an expense of threepence, I soon refreshed myself completely, and being in better spirits then, limped 7 miles upon my road. My bed at night was under another haystack, where I rested comfortably after having washed my blistered feet in a stream and dressed them as well as I was able with some cool leaves. When I took the road again next morning, I found that it lay through a succession of hop grounds and orchards. It was sufficiently late in the year for the orchards to be ruddy with ripe apples, and in a few places the hop pickers were already at work. I thought it all extremely beautiful, and made up my mind to sleep among the hops that night, imagining some cheerful companionship in the long perspectives of poles with the graceful leaves twining round them. The trampers were worse than ever that day, and inspired me with a dread that is yet quite fresh in my mind. Some of them were most ferocious-looking ruffians, who stared at me as I went by, and stopped, perhaps, and called after me to come back and speak to them, and when I took to my heels, stoned me. I recollect one young fellow, a tinker, I suppose, from his wallet and brazier, who had a woman with him, and who faced about and stared at me thus, and then roared to me in such a tremendous voice to come back that I halted and looked round. "Come here when you're called," said the tinker, "or I'll rip your young body open." I thought it best to go back. As I drew nearer to them, trying to propitiate the tinker by my looks, I observed that the woman had a black eye. "Where are you going?" said the tinker, griping the bosom of my shirt with his blackened hand. "I'm going to Dover," I said. "Where'd you come from?" asked the tinker, giving his hand another turn in my shirt to hold me more securely. "I come from London," I said. "What lay are you upon?" asked the tinker. "Are you a prig?" "No," I said. "Ain't you, by God? If you make a brag of your honesty to me," said the tinker, "I'll knock your brains out." With his disengaged hand he made a menace of striking me, and then looked at me from head to foot. "Have you got the price of a pint of beer about you?" said the tinker. "If you have, out with it afore I take it away." I should certainly have produced it, but that I met the woman's look, and saw her very slightly shake her head and form no with her lips. "I'm very poor," I said, attempting to smile, "and have got no money."
"Why, what do you mean?"
said the tinker, looking so sternly at me that I almost feared he saw the money in my pocket. "Sir," I stammered.
"What do you mean," said the tinker, "by wearing my brother's silk handkerchief? Give it over here."
And he had mine off my neck in a moment and tossed it to the woman. The woman burst into a fit of laughter, as if she thought this a joke, and tossing it back to me, nodded once, as slightly as before, and made the word "go" with her lips. Before I could obey, however, the tinker seized the handkerchief out of my hand with a roughness that threw me away like a feather, and putting it loosely round his own neck, turned upon the woman with an oath and knocked her down. I never shall forget seeing her fall backward on the hard road, and lie there with her bonnet tumbled off, and her hair all whitened in the dust. Nor, when I looked back from a distance, seeing her sitting on the pathway, which was a bank by the roadside, wiping the blood from her face with a corner of her shawl while he went on ahead. This adventure frightened me so that, afterwards, when I saw any of these people coming, I turned back until I could find a hiding place where I remained until they'd gone out of sight, which happened so often that I was very seriously delayed. But under this difficulty, as under all the other difficulties of my journey, I seemed to be sustained and led on by my fanciful picture of my mother in her youth, before I came into the world. It always kept me company. It was there, among the hops, when I lay down to sleep. It was with me on my waking in the morning. It went before me all day. I've associated it ever since with the sunny street of Canterbury, dozing, as it were, in the hot light, and with the sight of its old houses and gateways, and the stately grey cathedral, with the rooks sailing round the towers. When I came at last upon the bare wide downs near Dover, it relieved the solitary aspect of the scene with hope. And not until I reached that first great aim of my journey and actually set foot in the town itself on the sixth day of my flight, did it desert me. But then, strange to say, when I stood with my ragged shoes and my dusty, sunburned, half-clothed figure in the place so long desired, it seemed to vanish like a dream and to leave me helpless and dispirited. I inquired about my aunt among the boatmen first, and received various answers. One said she lived in the South Foreland Light and had singed her whiskers by doing so. Another that she was made fast to the great buoy outside the harbour and could only be visited at half-tide. A third that she was locked up in Maidstone Jail for child-stealing. A fourth that she was seen to mount a broom in the last high wind and make direct for Calais. The fly-drivers, among whom I inquired next, were equally jocose and equally disrespectful, and the shopkeepers, not liking my appearance, generally replied without hearing what I had to say, that they got nothing for me. I felt more miserable and destitute than I'd done at any period of my running away. My money was all gone. I had nothing left to dispose of. I was hungry, thirsty, and worn out, and seemed as distant from my end as if I'd remained in London. The morning had worn away in these inquiries, and I was sitting on the step of an empty shop at a street corner near the marketplace, deliberating upon wandering towards those other places which had been mentioned, when a fly driver, coming by with his carriage, dropped a horsecloth. Something good-natured in the man's face as I handed it up encouraged me to ask him if he could tell me where Miss Trotwood lived, though I had asked the question so often that it almost died upon my lips. "Trotwood," said he. "Let me see. I know the name, too. Old lady?" "Yes," I said, "rather." "Pretty stiff in the back?" said he, making himself upright. "Yes," I said, "I should think it very likely." "Carries a bag," said he. "Bag with a good deal of room in it. He's gruffish and comes down upon you sharp." My heart sank within me as I acknowledged the undoubted accuracy of this description. "Why, then, I tell you what," said he. "If you go up there," pointing with his whip towards the heights, "and keep right on till you come to some houses facing the sea, I think you'll hear of her. My opinion is she won't stand anything, so here's a penny for you." I accepted the gift thankfully and bought a loaf with it. Dispatching this refreshment, by the way, I went in the direction my friend had indicated, and walked on a good distance without coming to the houses he'd mentioned. At length I saw some before me, and approaching them went into a little shop, it was what we used to call a general shop at home, and inquired if they could have the goodness to tell me where Miss Trotwood lived. I addressed myself to a man behind the counter who was weighing some rice for a young woman, but the latter, taking the inquiry to herself, turned round quickly. "My mistress," she said, "what do you want with her boy?" "I want," I replied, "to speak to her, if you please." "To beg of her, you mean?" retorted the damsel. "No," I said, "indeed." But suddenly remembering that in truth I came for no other purpose, I held my peace in confusion and felt my face burn. "My aunt's handmaid," as I suppose she was from what she'd said, "put her rice in a little basket and walked out of the shop, telling me that I could follow her if I wanted to know where Miss Trotwood lived." I needed no second permission, though I was by this time in such a state of consternation and agitation that my legs shook under me. I followed the young woman, and we soon came to a very neat little cottage with cheerful bow windows. In front of it, a small, square, gravelled court or garden full of flowers carefully tended and smelling deliciously. "This is Miss Trotwood's," said the young woman. "Now you know. And that's all I've got to say." With which words she hurried into the house as if to shake off the responsibility of my appearance, and left me standing at the garden gate, looking disconsolately over the top of it towards the parlour window, where a muslin curtain, partly undrawn in the middle, a large, round, green screen or fan fastened onto the windowsill, a small table and a great chair, suggested to me that my aunt might be at that moment seated in awful state. My shoes were by this time in a woeful condition. The soles had shed themselves bit by bit, and the upper leathers had broken and burst until the very shape and form of shoes had departed from them. My hat, which had served me for a nightcap, too, was so crushed and bent that no old battered, handleless saucepan on a dunghill need have been ashamed to vie with it. My shirt and trousers, stained with heat, dew, grass, and the Kentish soil on which I'd slept, and torn besides, might have frightened the birds from my aunt's garden as I stood at the gate. My hair had known no comb or brush since I left London. My face, neck, and hands, from unaccustomed exposure to the air and sun, were burnt to a bedy brown. From head to foot, I was powdered almost as white with chalk and dust as if I'd come out of a lime kiln. In this plight, and with a strong consciousness of it, I waited to introduce myself to and make my first impression on my formidable aunt. The unbroken stillness of the parlour window leading me to infer after a while that she wasn't there, I lifted up my eyes to the window above it, where I saw a florid, pleasant-looking gentleman with a grey head, who shut up one eye in a grotesque manner, nodded his head at me several times, shook it at me as often, laughed, and went away. I'd been discomposed enough before, but I was so much the more discomposed by this unexpected behaviour that I was on the point of slinking off to think how I had best proceed, when there came out of the house a lady with a handkerchief tied over her cap and a pair of gardening gloves on her hands, wearing a gardening pocket like a tollman's apron, and carrying a great knife. I knew her immediately to be Miss Betsy, for she came stalking out of the house exactly as my poor mother had so often described her stalking up our garden at Blunderstone Rookery. "Go away," said Miss Betsy, shaking her head and making a distant chop in the air with her knife. "Go along! No boys here!" I watched her, with my heart at my lips, as she marched to a corner of her garden and stooped to dig up some little root there. Then, without a scrap of courage but with a great deal of desperation, I went softly in and stood beside her, touching her with my finger. "If you please, ma'am," I began. She started and looked up. "If you please, aunt." "Eh?" exclaimed Miss Betsy, in a tone of amazement I have never heard approached. "If you please, aunt, I'm your nephew." "Oh, Lord," said my aunt, and sat flat down in the garden path. "I'm David Copperfield of Blunderstone in Suffolk, where you came on the night I was born and saw my dear mamma. I've been very unhappy since she died. I've been slighted and taught nothing and thrown upon myself and put to work not fit for me. It made me run away to you. I was robbed at first setting out and have walked all the way and have never slept in a bed since I began the journey. Here my self-support gave way all at once, and with a movement of my hands intended to show her my ragged state and call it to witness that I had suffered something, I broke into a passion of crying which I suppose had been pent up within me all the week. My aunt, with every sort of expression but wonder discharged from her countenance, sat on the gravel staring at me until I began to cry, when she got up in a great hurry, collared me, and took me into the parlour. Her first proceeding there was to unlock a tall press, bring out several bottles, and pour some of the contents of each into my mouth. I think they must have been taken out at random, for I'm sure I tasted aniseed water, anchovy sauce, and salad dressing. When she'd administered these restoratives, as I was still quite hysterical and unable to control my sobs, she put me on the sofa with a shawl under my head and the handkerchief from my own head under my feet, lest I should sully the cover, and then, sitting herself down behind the green fan or screen I've already mentioned, so that I couldn't see her face, ejaculated at intervals, "Mercy on us!" letting those exclamations off like minute guns. After a time, she rang the bell. "Janet," said my aunt, when her servant came in, "go upstairs, give my compliments to Mr. Dick, and say I wish to speak to him." Janet looked a little surprised to see me lying stiffly on the sofa. I was afraid to move, lest it should be displeasing to my aunt, but went on her errand. My aunt, with her hands behind her, walked up and down the room until the gentleman who had squinted at me from the upper window came in laughing. "Mr. Dick," said my aunt, "don't be a fool, because nobody can be more discreet than you can when you choose. We all know that, so don't be a fool, whatever you are." The gentleman was serious immediately, and looked at me, I thought, as if he would entreat me to say nothing about the window. "Mr. Dick," said my aunt, "you've heard me mention David Copperfield. Now don't pretend not to have a memory, because you and I know better." "David Copperfield," said Mr. Dick, who didn't appear to me to remember much about it. "David Copperfield? Oh, yes, to be sure, David, certainly." "Well," said my aunt, "this is his boy, his son. He would be as like his father as it's possible to be if he was not so like his mother, too." "His son," said Mr. Dick. "David's son, indeed." "Yes," pursued my aunt, "and he's done a pretty piece of business. He's run away." "Ah! His sister Betsy Trotwood never would have run away." My aunt shook her head firmly, confident in the character and behaviour of the girl who never was born. "Oh, you think she wouldn't have run away?" said Mr. Dick. "Bless and save the man," exclaimed my aunt sharply. "How he talks! Don't I know she wouldn't? She would have lived with her godmother, and we should have been devoted to one another. Where in the name of wonder should his sister Betsy Trotwood have run from or to?" "Nowhere," said Mr. Dick. "Well, then," returned my aunt, softened by the reply, "how can you pretend to be wool-gathering, Dick, when you're as sharp as a surgeon's lancet? Now, here you see young David Copperfield, and the question I put to you is, what shall I do with him?" "What shall you do with him?" said Mr. Dick feebly, scratching his head. "Oh, do with him?" "Yes," said my aunt with a grave look and her forefinger held up. "Come, I want some very sound advice. Why, if I was you," said Mr. Dick, considering and looking vacantly at me, "I should..." The contemplation of me seemed to inspire him with a sudden idea, and he added briskly, "I should wash him." "Janet," said my aunt, turning round with a quiet triumph, which I didn't then understand, "Mr. Dick sets us all right. Heat the bath." Although I was deeply interested in this dialogue, I couldn't help observing my aunt, Mr. Dick, and Janet while it was in progress, and completing a survey I had already been engaged in making of the room. My aunt was a tall, hard-featured lady, but by no means ill-looking. There was an inflexibility in her face, in her voice, in her gait and carriage, amply sufficient to account for the effect she had made upon a gentle creature like my mother. But her features were rather handsome than otherwise, though unbending and austere. I particularly noticed that she had a very quick, bright eye. Her hair, which was grey, was arranged in two plain divisions under what I believe would be called a mob cap. I mean a cap much more common then than now, with side pieces fastening under the chin. Her dress was of a lavender colour and perfectly neat, but scantily made, as if she desired to be as little encumbered as possible. I remember that I thought it in form more like a riding habit with the superfluous skirt cut off than anything else. She wore at her side a gentleman's gold watch, if I might judge from its size and make, with an appropriate chain and seals. She had some linen at her throat, not unlike a shirt collar, and things at her wrists, like little shirt wristbands. Mr. Dick, as I've already said, was grey-headed and florid. I should have said all about him in saying so, had not his head been curiously bowed, not by age. It reminded me of one of Mr. Creakle's boy's heads after a beating. and his grey eyes, prominent and large, with a strange kind of watery brightness in them, that made me, in combination with his vacant manner, his submission to my aunt, and his childish delight when she praised him, suspect him of being a little mad. Though, if he were mad, how he came to be there puzzled me extremely. He was dressed like any other ordinary gentleman, in a loose grey morning coat and waistcoat, and white trousers, and had his watch in his fob, and his money in his pockets, which he rattled as if he were very proud of it. Janet was a pretty, blooming girl, of about 19 or 20, and a perfect picture of neatness. Though I made no further observation of her at the moment, I may mention here what I didn't discover until afterwards, namely, that she was one of a series of protégés whom my aunt had taken into her service expressly to educate in a renouncement of mankind, and who had generally completed their abjuration by marrying the baker. The room was as neat as Janet or my aunt. As I laid down my pen a moment since to think of it, the air from the sea came blowing in again mixed with the perfume of the flowers, and I saw the old-fashioned furniture brightly rubbed and polished, my aunt's inviolable chair and table by the round green fan in the bow window, the drugget-covered carpet, the cat, the kettle holder, the two canaries, the old china, the punch-bowl full of dried rose-leaves, the tall press guarding all sorts of bottles and pots, and, wonderfully out of keeping with the rest, my stained and dusty self upon the sofa taking note of everything. Janet had gone away to get the bath ready when my aunt, to my great alarm, became in one moment rigid with indignation and had hardly voice to cry out, "Janet! Donkeys!" Upon which Janet came running up the stairs as if the house were in flames, darted out on the little piece of green in front, and warned off two saddle donkeys, lady-ridden, that had presumed to set hoof upon it, while my aunt, rushing out of the house, seized the bridle of a third animal, laden with a bestriding child, turned him, led him forth from those sacred precincts, and boxed the ears of the unlucky urchin in attendance who had dared to profane that hallowed ground. To this hour, I don't know whether my aunt had any lawful right of way over that patch of green, but she'd settled it in her own mind that she had, and it was all the same to her. The one great outrage of her life, demanding to be constantly avenged, was the passage of a donkey over that immaculate spot. In whatever occupation she was engaged, however interesting to her the conversation in which she was taking part, a donkey turned the current of her ideas in a moment, and she was upon him straight. Jugs of water and watering pots were kept in secret places, ready to be discharged on the offending boys. Sticks were laid in ambush behind the door. Sallies were made at all hours, and incessant war prevailed. Perhaps this was an agreeable excitement to the donkey boys, or perhaps the more sagacious of the donkeys, understanding how the case stood, persisted with constitutional obstinacy in coming that way. I only know that there were three alarms before the bath was ready, and that on the occasion of the last and most desperate of all, I saw my aunt engage single-handed with a sandy-headed lad of 15 and bump his sandy head against her own gate before he seemed to comprehend what was the matter. These interruptions were the more ridiculous to me because she was giving me broth out of a tablespoon at the time, having firmly persuaded herself that I was actually starving, and must receive nourishment at first in very small quantities. And while my mouth was yet open to receive the spoon, she would put it back into the basin, cry, "Janet! Donkeys!" and go out to the assault. The bath was a great comfort, for I began to be sensible of acute pains in my limbs from lying out in the fields, and was now so tired and low that I could hardly keep myself awake for 5 minutes together. When I bathed, my aunt and Janet, enrobed me in a shirt and a pair of trousers belonging to Mr. Dick, and tied me up in two or three great shawls. What sort of bundle I looked like, I don't know, but I felt a very hot one. Feeling also very faint and drowsy, I soon lay down on the sofa again and fell asleep. It might have been a dream, originating in the fancy which had occupied my mind so long, but I awoke with the impression that my aunt had come and bent over me, and had put my hair away from my face, and laid my head more comfortably, and had then stood looking at me. The words, "pretty fellow," or "poor fellow," seemed to be in my ears, too. But certainly there was nothing else when I awoke to lead me to believe that they had been uttered by my aunt, who sat in the bow window gazing at the sea from behind the green fan, which was mounted on a kind of swivel and turned any way. We dined soon after I awoke, off of roast fowl and a pudding, I sitting at table not unlike a trussed bird myself, and moving my arms with considerable difficulty. But as my aunt had swathed me up, I made no complaint of being inconvenienced. All this time I was deeply anxious to know what she was going to do with me. But she took her dinner in profound silence, except when she occasionally fixed her eyes on me sitting opposite and said, "Mercy upon us," which didn't by any means relieve my anxiety. The cloth being drawn and some sherry put upon the table, of which I had a glass, my aunt sent up for Mr. Dick again, who joined us, and looked as wise as he could when she requested him to attend to my story, which she elicited from me, gradually, by a course of questions. During my recital she kept her eyes on Mr. Dick, who I thought would have gone to sleep but for that, and who, whensoever he lapsed into a smile, was checked by a frown from my aunt. "What ever possessed that poor, unfortunate baby that she must go and be married again?" said my aunt when I'd finished. "I can't conceive." "Perhaps she fell in love with her second husband," Mr. Dick suggested. "Fell in love?" repeated my aunt. "What do you mean? What business had she to do it?" "Perhaps," Mr. Dick simpered after thinking a little, "she did it for pleasure."
"Pleasure, indeed!" replied my aunt. "A mighty pleasure for the poor baby to pin her simple faith upon any dog of a fellow, certain to ill-use her in some way or other. What did she propose to herself, I should like to know? She'd had one husband. She'd seen David Copperfield out of the world, who was always running after wax dolls from his cradle. She'd got a baby. Oh, there were a pair of babies when she gave birth to this child sitting here that Friday night, and what more did she want?"
Mr. Dick secretly shook his head at me as if he thought there was no getting over this.
"She couldn't even have a baby like anybody else," said my aunt. "Where was this child's sister, Betsy Trotwood? Not forthcoming, don't tell me!"
Mr. Dick seemed quite frightened.
"That little man of a doctor with his head on one side," said my aunt. "Jellips, or whatever his name was, what was he about? All he could do was to say to me, like a robin redbreast, as he is, 'It's a boy, a boy!' Yeah! The imbecility of the whole set of..."
The heartiness of the ejaculation startled Mr. Dick exceedingly, and me too, if I'm to tell the truth.
"And then, as if this was not enough, and she had not stood sufficiently in the light of this child's sister, Betsy Trotwood," said my aunt, "she marries a second time, goes and marries a murderer, or a man with a name like it, and stands in this child's light. And the natural consequence is, as anybody but a baby might have foreseen, that he prowls and wanders. He's as like Cain before he was grown up as he can be."
Mr. Dick looked hard at me as if to identify me in this character.
"And then there's that woman with the pagan name," said my aunt, "that Peggotty. She goes and gets married next. Because she's not seen enough of the evil attending such things, she goes and gets married next, as the child relates. I only hope," said my aunt, shaking her head, "that her husband is one of those poker husbands who abound in the newspapers, and will beat her well with one." I couldn't bear to hear my old nurse so decried, and made the subject of such a wish. I told my aunt that indeed she was mistaken, that Peggotty was the best, the truest, the most faithful, most devoted, and most self-denying friend and servant in the world, who had ever loved me dearly, who had ever loved my mother dearly, who had held my mother's dying head upon her arm, on whose face my mother had imprinted her last grateful kiss. And my remembrance of them both choking me, I broke down,
as I was trying to say that her home was my home, and that all she had was mine, and that I would have gone to her for shelter but for her humble station, which made me fear that I might bring some trouble on her. I broke down, I say, as I was trying to say so, and laid my face in my hands upon the table. "Well, well," said my aunt, "the child is right to stand by those who have stood by him." "Janet! Donkeys!" I thoroughly believe that but for those unfortunate donkeys, we should have come to a good understanding. For my aunt had laid her hand on my shoulder, and the impulse was upon me, thus emboldened, to embrace her and beseech her protection. But the interruption and the disorder she was thrown into by the struggle outside put an end to all softer ideas for the present, and kept my aunt indignantly declaiming to Mr. Dick about her determination to appeal for redress to the laws of her country, and to bring actions for trespass against the whole donkey proprietorship of Dover until tea time. After tea we sat at the window, on the lookout, as I imagined from my aunt's sharp expression of face, for more invaders, until dusk, when Janet set candles and a backgammon board on the table and pulled down the blinds. "Now, Mr. Dick," said my aunt, with her grave look and her forefinger up as before, "I'm going to ask you another question. Look at this child." "David's son?" said Mr. Dick, with an attentive, puzzled face. "Exactly so," returned my aunt. "What would you do with him now?" "Do with David's son?" said Mr. Dick. "I," replied my aunt, "with David's son." "Oh," said Mr. Dick. "Yes, do with... I should put him to bed." "Janet," cried my aunt, with the same complacent triumph that I'd remarked before, "Mr. Dick sets us all right. If the bed's ready, we'll take him up to it." Janet reporting it to be quite ready, I was taken up to it, kindly, but in some sort like a prisoner, my aunt going in front and Janet bringing up the rear. The only circumstance which gave me any new hope was my aunt's stopping on the stairs to inquire about a smell of fire that was prevalent there, and Janet's replying that she had been making tinder down in the kitchen of my old shirt. But there were no other clothes in my room than the odd heap of things I wore, and when I was left there with a little taper which my aunt forewarned me would burn exactly 5 minutes, I heard them lock my door on the outside. Turning these things over in my mind, I deemed it possible that my aunt, who could know nothing of me, might suspect I had a habit of running away, and took precautions on that account to have me in safe keeping. The room was a pleasant one at the top of the house, overlooking the sea, on which the moon was shining brilliantly. After I'd said my prayers and the candle had burnt out, I remember how I still sat looking at the moonlight on the water, as if I could hope to read my fortune in it, as in a bright book, or to see my mother with her child coming from heaven along that shining path, to look upon me as she had looked when I last saw her sweet face. I remember how the solemn feeling with which at length I turned my eyes away yielded to the sensation of gratitude and rest which the sight of the white curtained bed, and how much more the lying softly down upon it, nestling in the snow-white sheets, inspired. I remember how I thought of all the solitary places under the night sky where I'd slept, and how I prayed that I never might be houseless any more, and never might forget the houseless. I remember how I seemed to float then down the melancholy glory of that track upon the sea, away into the world of dreams.
This ends side one of cassette 7. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.
Chapter 14. My aunt makes up her mind about me. On going down in the morning, I found my aunt musing so profoundly over the breakfast table with her elbow on the tray that the contents of the urn had overflowed the teapot and were laying the whole tablecloth under water when my entrance put her meditations to flight. I felt sure that I had been the subject of her reflections, and was more than ever anxious to know her intentions towards me. Yet I dared not express my anxiety, lest it should give her offence. My eyes, however, not being so